Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 4th of May, these are our main stories. Gunfire and explosions in the Sudanese capital Khartoum, despite hopes of a seven-day ceasefire between the two warring generals. Russia blames the United States for Wednesday's alleged drone attack on the Kremlin. Meanwhile, Ukraine's President Zelensky tells the International Criminal Court he believes it will soon host Vladimir Putin. Also in this podcast, we speak to the man taking on President Erdogan. And scientists get their hands on human DNA from 20,000 years ago.
This date of around 20,000 years ago was the peak of the last ice age, so it would have been very cold.
Despite all the remonstrations and supposed ceasefires, and despite the international outcry and huge evacuation effort, the sound of fighting continues to resound across the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. There has also been intensive bombardment in the adjoining cities of Omdurman and Bari. The army has again said it was ready to abide by a ceasefire, but there's been no response from the rival paramilitary, the Rapid Support Forces. The United Nations aid chief has said it will be difficult to secure an end to the fighting as the warring parties seem keen to keep it going. Martin Griffiths was speaking to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, after a visit to Port Sudan.
It's a shocking crisis, first, because, as you have heard, and as I have now heard, the tales of traumatic atrocity that we have seen, they have seen, in Khartoum, and of course Darfur is lighting up, are pretty unparalleled. That's appalling. And as people say, that will lead to a generational problem of reconciliation anyway. The second, I think, really, really deeply concerning aspect is the speed with which, of course, it's going viral, and the way in which all these efforts to get national ceasefires or local ceasefires or temporary ceasefires have all stumbled presumably over the sort of rigid existential fact that those at war are keen to keep going. So it's got all the makings of a tragedy of global relevance and global significance. And that's why this is an opportunity for the international community to show that we care about Africa.
During your time in Port Sudan, you had telephone conversations with the two warring leaders, General Burhan and General Hamdan. What did you hear from them? What assurances did you get?
What I said to them was this. I said, this is about specific protections for the movement of aid workers, persons, people, and goods and supplies, going down certain roads at certain times, airlift protected from being shot down and so forth. So very, very concrete asks. But you two need to give us those assurances, and I want to meet you to go through those assurances. So they were both, obviously separately, very eloquent in their attachment to humanitarian principles and aspirations on the question of where and when can we meet? And I think it's obviously urgent. This should be done in the next day or so. We're working on it.
The UN's Martin Griffiths speaking to Lise Doucette. Let's get the latest from Mercy Juma in Nairobi.
Martin Griffiths used the word appalling. And, you know, I think that's the best word to describe what is going on in Sudan now, you know. Three truces have failed. Another one was supposed to be in effect now and to go for 7 days, but that's not holding, you know. People, again, in parts of Khartoum, in other areas of Sudan, have woken up to, you know, jet fighters on the air, while other people on the ground, that is the RSF, trying to shoot these jet fighters. There's a lot of gunfire and, you know, just a lot of chaos. And it's really coming to a point where, you know, they are coming out and saying, most of them thought that this is just something that will last maybe for 4 or 5 days, and these two generals will, you know, come to their senses, hopefully, and sit down and negotiate. But it's now seemingly looking like something that is going to go on forever because, you know, while people are talking about mediation, the army, an envoy from Al-Burhan's side, say they are committing to a truce, which they are not abiding to and sent to RSF, but they are not committing to a negotiation or mediation at this point. So, unfortunately, at this point, it looks like it's going to be another really long day and probably a couple more days and weeks if any negotiation does not happen.
Mercy Juma in Nairobi. The Kremlin is now blaming Washington for an alleged drone attack on its headquarters on Wednesday. Moscow initially blamed Kyiv directly, but without evidence, the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has now alleged to reporters that Kyiv executed the strike on US orders.
We know very well that the decisions on such actions, on such acts of terrorism, are made not in Kyiv, but in Washington. And Kyiv is only doing what it is told to do. In fact, we know that it is often not Kyiv that even determines the goals themselves, but they are determined by Washington and then brought to Kyiv so that it fulfills them.
A White House spokesman has denied Russia's claims and says Washington does not encourage or enable Ukraine to strike outside its borders. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, told me more about Russia's allegations.
The Kremlin continues to claim that this was a Ukrainian drone attack, but today it went one step further and suggested that America was behind the explosions over the Kremlin without providing any evidence for that, I hasten to add. So Dmitry Peskov said that decisions about such actions, such terrorist attacks, as he called them, are made not in Kyiv, but in Washington. But this isn't very surprising, I have to say, because for a long time now, the Kremlin has blamed Washington for the war in Ukraine. It often accuses the West of waging a war against Russia in Ukraine. This is part of the parallel reality, really, which is created by Moscow around what is happening there. In reality, of course, it was President Putin's decision back in February 2022 to launch a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But, of course, blaming America, blaming the West, blaming NATO, blaming Britain is one way of deflecting criticism at home for what is going on in Ukraine.
And presumably it's also something that could be used as justification for whatever Vladimir Putin is planning to do next.
Yes, I mean, you know, the Kremlin often looks for scapegoats. And it uses the West, uses America particularly, as a scapegoat for all of Russia's problems. So when you switch on Russian state television, for example, there is so much anti-American, anti-British rhetoric directed at the public. So, as I say, Mr. Peskov's comments today are not surprising in that context.
What is coming next, then? There's fears, after some fairly stern statements from the Kremlin, that something big is being planned.
Well, we simply don't know. I mean, there's so much about what happened with those explosions over the Kremlin that we don't know. You know, the Kremlin has said this was a Ukrainian drone attack, and it blames America for basically telling Ukraine what to target. But, you know, there's no confirmation of that. And although the Kremlin has said that this was an assassination attempt on the life of President Putin, even Russian television last night suggested that these kind of drones that were used couldn't carry enough explosives to create substantial damage and suggested that this was just for show, the reporter said. So even Russian television dampening down that claim that this was an attempt on the life of the Russian president. But there's been so much speculation here about what this actually was, who was behind it. You know, was Ukraine behind it to send a message to the Kremlin that it could reach President Putin whenever and wherever it wants? Or was this the work of Russian partisans? Some people suggest that it was even the work of the Russian authorities or elements of the Russian security services looking for a pretext to escalate the war in Ukraine. But, you know, we do not have the full picture yet, so we can't answer all those questions.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for a fully-fledged tribunal to hold Russia accountable for its war of aggression against Ukraine. He made the comments after visiting the International Criminal Court, which has previously issued an arrest warrant for President Vladimir Putin over alleged war crimes. Today in The Hague, President Zelensky called for further punishment for Russia.
Peace calls for sanctions to be stronger, for the isolation of Russia to be more complete. Peace calls for assets of terrorist state to be confiscated, and peace calls damages to be repaired and ruins to be rebuilt.
The visit is deeply symbolic. I spoke to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
The Hague is sometimes billed as the international legal capital of the world, Alex, and President Zelensky is on a crusade for justice. So he visited the ICC amid heavy security. He shook hands with the president of the court, who was the person who announced the arrest warrants for Vladimir Putin and his Children's Rights Commissioner, Maria Lvova-Belova, related to the unlawful deportation of children from Ukraine. Straight after his visit to the ICC, he went on and made that call for an international tribunal. He said basically only an international tribunal can tackle the crime of aggression, which is the crime that underpins all the other crimes in Ukraine. And he said by defeating impunity, you then stop aggression worldwide. So very important there. He drew on MH17, which is something very close to the Netherlands' heart. Lots of people in that flight that was downed at the beginning of the war in Ukraine in 2014 were Dutch. And he also drew on the Nuremberg tribunals after the Second World War. And today is the Dutch Day of Remembrance for all the victims of the Second World War. So what Ukraine is doing is it's positioning itself at the forefront of the battle for freedom globally.
Fine words, of course, butter no parsnips. How achievable are the ICC's goals in bringing Russia to justice?
Well, President Zelensky expressed confidence. He says that everyone wants to see what he called a different Vladimir, referring to President Putin there in The Hague for sentencing. The reality, of course, is much more complex. Russia does not recognise the ICC and it doesn't extradite its nationals as suspects, at least its own head of state. And so it complicates President Putin's travels abroad. But it's a very different thing to say, you know, you can't go to countries that are members of the ICC for fear of arrest to actually appearing in The Hague.
And we've heard of strikes this morning, Danny, in Kyiv and elsewhere in the country.
Yeah, so President Zelensky is continuing his push for greater military assistance from both the Prime Minister of the Netherlands and the Belgian Prime Minister, who's also there for talks, wanting more armed vehicles to complement the tanks that they've received. And he's referring to some of the recent attacks, shelling in Kherson, where 23 people were killed, and also a series more of further drone strikes on cities like Kyiv, Odessa and Zaporizhia overnight.
Danny Eberhardt. With less than 2 weeks to go before presidential and parliamentary elections in Turkey, opinion polls suggest the authoritarian leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan could be defeated after 20 years in power. His main rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, has a narrow lead in the polls. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Gerin, met him in the city of Izmir.
I'm by the sea in the port of Izmir, waiting to take a ferry with the man who could be the next leader of Turkey, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. He's the main challenger to President Erdogan, but his style is low-key, gentle, non-confrontational. He's offering Turks a very different vision for their future, for their country. In many ways, this softly spoken former civil servant is the anti-Erdogan. And he's hopping on the ferry to go to a rally of his supporters on the other side of the bay. He's welcomed ashore. Kılıçdaroğlu is our hope, they chant. There's a sea of flag-waving supporters, many of them young. Everything will be beautiful, he says at the rally. Believe it. And they do, especially here in Izmir,
a stronghold of the opposition.
Mr. Kılıçdaroğlu, lovely to meet you. Thank you for giving us your time. What will be the biggest change in Turkey if you are the next leader here?
Özgürlük, gençlerin özgürlüğü.
Freedom for the youth, as soon as possible. They want democracy. They don't want the police to come to their doors early in the morning just because they tweeted.
People have been saying to me in the last few weeks that they are worried for your safety, that they're even worried for your life now that you are ahead in the polls. Do you have any concerns about your safety?
Erdogan and his supporters can't scare me. I made a promise to this nation. I'll bring democracy and freedom.
In effect, you're saying that your life may be at risk, but you're prepared to take that risk.
Politics in Turkey is a bit like this.
If you become president of Turkey, what will be more important for you? Relations with Russia or relations with the West?
Relations with the West. In 1963, we declared our will to join the European Union. We want to become a part of the civilized world. Erdogan does not think that way. It's the opposite. He wants to be more authoritarian. The difference between us and Erdogan is the difference between black and white.
But the president has plenty of support, especially among religious conservatives. This was his rally in Izmir. It was segregated, men on one side, women on the other, and there was plenty of devotion.
What does he mean to you personally?
He is very reassuring. He even looks reassuring. He keeps all his promises. He helps the old, the disabled. He helps everyone.
It looks pretty certain that this election will be a photo finish, and the presidency probably won't be decided until a second round. There is excitement here, but as the election draws closer, there's also a growing tension. Many here are saying they don't know what will happen, and no one can be sure that things will be peaceful.
Orla Geren speaking to Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Now, it's not often that we have any insight at all into the daily lives of people who came a long time before us. I'm talking 20,000 years. It's a tiny glimpse, courtesy of some extraordinary archaeological work. We're talking about a pendant and a woman who wore it. Professor Chris Stringer is research leader in human evolution at the Natural History Museum in London.
This is from a remarkable site in Siberia, Denisova Cave. Russian archaeologists have been digging it for many years, and they discovered a pendant made from a deer tooth, probably worn as a necklace by somebody. And the exceptional preservation of this artifact, the fact that it had been handled so little, meant that they'd been able to actually recover not only the DNA of the deer that the pendant came from, but also of the person who probably was wearing it. Probably from skin cells or sweat on the body, the DNA, and it turns out to be the DNA of a woman. We've got to bear in mind that, you know, this was an exceptional find. Unfortunately, many objects in museums, of course, have been handled by many people over the years, so they will have the DNA of many people contaminating it. In this case, the object was taken out of the ground and kept separate and barely handled. This date of around 20,000 years ago was the peak of the last ice age, so it would have been very cold. And at the time, this site was well provisioned. We know that there were plenty of plant and animal resources. They were mobile hunter-gatherers living off the land. So it was a harsh life, but they were able to sustain it 20,000 years ago.
Professor Chris Stringer of the Natural History Museum. Coming up, the strange noises heard by climbers on Mount Everest. It's not ghosts or yetis. It's something much more frightening. Three Palestinian militants, two of them suspected of killing three Jewish settlers, have been shot dead by Israeli forces. They died in the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank, where the three women, a mother and her two daughters, were attacked last month. Our correspondent Yoland Nell is in Jerusalem.
Nablus, local Palestinians have been gathering around the damaged house where they say they heard an explosion at the start of this Israeli military raid. Israeli forces say that the apartment there was being used as a hideout by the gunmen that they were searching for and that they were killed in an exchange of fire. Now, all three men were members of the Islamist militant group Hamas, and you could see the green flag of Hamas being waved at their funeral, which has already taken place. Hamas has put out a statement calling those three men heroes, and it has said that they carried out the attack in the Jordan Valley in the West Bank a month ago, which killed three British Israelis, Lucy Dee and her daughters. They were in their car. Hamas said that that attack was carried out in response to an Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque here in Jerusalem during Ramadan. Now, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who visited the Dee family to give his condolences in the West Bank settlement where they lived after the attack, has said that today Israel has come to terms with their murderers. There has been, since the start of this year, a real surge in deadly Israeli-Palestinian violence, and we have had near daily Israeli military raids in the West Bank and also a series of Palestinian attacks. And if you look at the figures, some 20 people have been killed on the Israeli side, two of them foreigners, nearly all of those civilians since the start of the year, and more than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. That includes militants and civilians.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. The Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has told a meeting of far-right politicians in Budapest to look to his country as a model for nationalists all over the world. Nick Thorpe reports from Budapest.
Viktor Orbán is the poster boy of right-wing politicians around the world, and the Conservative Political Action Conference, known by its initials, CPAC, is his chance to speak to his admirers. Progressive liberal laboratories, he said in his keynote speech, have launched a virus against our nations, which aims to pulverise them. Migration, gender and the woke movement are all variants of that virus, he added. Hungary is the only country in Europe where CPAC gatherings are held, and over 2 days, conservative and nationalist politicians from many countries are holding talks in Budapest.
Nick Thorpe in Budapest. Preparations for the coronation ceremony of King Charles III are underway in the UK. The streets here are adorned with flags and banners, and for days now, some people have already bagged themselves spots along the streets near Buckingham Palace. But how is the upcoming event being viewed around the world? Journalist Elizabeth Ohini, a former BBC colleague, has covered Charles's various visits to Ghana, once a British colony, over the past four decades. She reflects on changing public attitudes in the country to the British monarchy and wonders whether the coronation will mean anything at all to Africans thousands of miles away. This report by Aaron Akinyemi.
Prince Charles arrived at the passing out parade, escorted by Ghanaian lancers.
When King Charles made his first visit to Ghana in 1977, veteran journalist Elizabeth Ohini was a young reporter and columnist for Ghana's leading newspaper, The Daily Graphic.
The parade was, in almost every detail, modelled on British drill and procedures.
Flipping through old photographs and articles from the time at her home in Accra, Elizabeth explains the sentiment towards the royal family at the time.
This was a visit that was extremely important for the establishment. Of course, we tried to spruce up the roads on which he would travel. Ghana was still very much linked to our former colonial master. In 1977, we had a military government, so we were not really on the route for many international visits.
The Ghana the prince will see in the coming week is a country under military rule.
As both a former colony of the British Empire and a nation where nearly every village has its own royalty, Ghana is no stranger to the pomp and circumstance of regal pageantry.
Then he went to Kumasi and was treated to a full-scale Durbar of chiefs. This is something that you've got to come to Ghana to see and believe for yourself. A riot of colors and kente and drumming and dancing and more gold in one place than you've ever seen anywhere. And I would say that Prince Charles looked suitably impressed.
4 decades on from King Charles's first trip, Elizabeth says public regard for British monarchy has shifted.
Ghana is now a far more open place. The UK is no longer our one source of going abroad. For the younger people whose lives are led by social media, if it plays big on social media, they would follow it. If it doesn't, I'm afraid I don't think they would.
Britain's monarch is no longer the head of state in any of its 14 former African territories, a result of independence campaigns by Africans that were resisted strongly, and in some cases violently, by the British government during Elizabeth's reign. Charles has referenced the debate as a fundamental issue. While dissenting conversations about Britain's colonial past have only grown in Africa, Elizabeth believes the crown will hold.
As for the future of the royal family, who knows? Who knows? I have this feeling that the British royal family will be around for a long, long time.
Aaron Akinyemi in Ghana. The Virgin Airlines boss, Richard Branson, says he feared the collapse of his entire business empire during the pandemic. COVID-19 restrictions grounded his fleet of aircraft and closed his extensive chain of health clubs. The British businessman says the possibility that tens of thousands of his employees could lose their jobs left him with a deep sense of personal depression. He was speaking to my colleague Amal Rajan from his private island in the Caribbean.
There was a time where it really looked like we were going to lose everything. We had 50, 60 planes all on the ground, and the health clubs all closed, the hotels all closed, and, you know, the worst would have been, 60,000 people out in the streets. But personally, I was fortunate in that our kids managed to get to the island, and our grandkids got to the island. And so, although I experienced maybe a couple of months of what people must feel when they're, pretty low, and I never experienced that before in my life.
Do you mean that for the first time in your life you were depressed?
Yeah, I was certainly a little depressed.
Your reputation took a bit of a hit during that early phase in the pandemic because senior members of your team had written to the government saying that they needed hundreds of millions of pounds in a government loan to save the company and save your airline. And yet there was coverage, people saying, hang on, Branson's a billionaire. He lives on an island in the Caribbean. Surely he can find the money.
I'd never really had any coverage quite as painful as that.
Really?
And it's complicated, so it's difficult to explain to people when everybody's hurting. I mean, there were pretty well no families that weren't hurting. But what we were concerned to do was to try to get government support. Not gifts from government, but underwriting loans.
Now at 72, Sir Richard says he discusses succession planning with his family, but he's still in control of the Virgin Group, and he's still as competitive as ever.
Amal Rajan speaking to Richard Branson. More and more people are climbing Everest, but apart from the obvious dangers, would-be climbers also have to deal with this. Some spirit of the mountain, perhaps, or a yeti. Now researchers in Japan have worked out where the sounds actually do come from. Terry Egan reports.
Sunset in the Himalayas, and as the temperature drops, a cascade of creepy sounds bursts out from inside the glaciers around Mount Everest. The researchers wanted to find out where those sounds came from and spent 3 weeks measuring vibrations in the glaciers using the same technology as is used for earthquakes. Once they arrived back at sea level, they were able to confirm that the noises were due to the extreme cold, the temperature falling so sharply that the ice begins to boom. Evgeny Podolsky from Hokkaido University Arctic Research Center led the team.
The life of ice is full of stress because it's flowing under gravity and stretching the glacier and causing crevices and cracks. But Himalayan glaciers are not so fast. They're kind of slow-moving creatures. And to our surprise, there is another process causing a lot of cracking at night, which we can hear in our tents due to temperature change.
Thermal fracturing inside the ice reveals it's melting very quickly, another result of climate change. Ice sheets in the region have shrunk by up to 10 times faster over the last 40 years than the centuries before that. In fact, a study done in 2021 suggests the Himalayan glaciers have lost up to 2/5 of their area in the last few hundred years. Nothing to do with mountain spirits or yetis then, but it could be much more threatening.
Terry Egan. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Neva Masirian, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martina Vik Magnussen went missing after a night out with friends in London.
I wonder what on earth could have happened.
We were so obsessed with just finding her.
Then...
Magnussen ble drepen etter å ha blitt påført...
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
I'm Noelle McHaffey, and I've been following this story since Martina was killed, making a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened and find the only suspect in the case. Farouk Abdelhak.
Leave me a message and I'll get back to you.
He's never been questioned by the police. Nobody's been able to speak to him. Until now. Murder in Mayfair. You can listen to the whole story now. Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.